From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on this show, we're talking about rum, and not the Captain Morgan variety. Find out why mixologists have fallen so in love with the spirit. Plus, what does Fidel Castro have in common with Bacardi? One chef's fight to keep an old-fashioned ingredient alive. Plus, Jonathan Gold takes us out for beers and Mexican in Whittier. And a community oven launches in Los Angeles. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Apparently, summer has arrived. This is what all the farmers and the customers are telling me because we have a profusion of fresh fruit in the market today. We're going to be talking with Amelia Saltzman, who is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook and whose new summer edition, summer entertaining ebook is out now. And Amelia is going to talk to us today about special recipes, very summery, very seasonal, using rhubarb. Amelia, what are you going to be cooking up with the rhubarb?
Well, first of all, let's qualify something. Rhubarb isn't a fruit. Rhubarb is actually a vegetable. It is related to sorrel and buckwheat. And like sorrel, it's really tart from the same thing, from oxalic acid. And, we don't get a lot of rhubarb in Southern California, so most of us are not very familiar with it. It's a big deal in cold climates. It gets very red, very juicy. But here we see a lot more green-tinged rhubarb.
It's a stalk. Let's describe it. Because when you say sorrel, you're thinking a leaf. But this is actually a stalk, and the green rhubarb almost looks like celery.
That's exactly right. In fact, even the red one looks sort of like red celery stalks. And then there are leaves that look sort of charred-like at the very top. But the leaves are poisonous. You don't eat the leaves. That's why we always see just the stalk carefully trimmed at a farmer's market or anywhere for that matter. So one of the things, of course, I like to do is see what is the simplest thing I can do with an ingredient that I find here at the market. And I decided to try roasting it. I roasted it with a tiny bit of sugar. I would say that maybe a pound of rhubarb, which is a lot of rhubarb, would take maybe a third of a cup of sugar. And I used a golden brown sugar, heated up the oven to 400 degrees, cut up pieces of rhubarb with the sugar and roasted it in a non-reactive pan. This is important for rhubarb. So I just tossed it together, threw it in the oven for about 20 minutes. And what happened was the pieces of rhubarb, some of them caramelized, some of them stayed wonderfully pink, some of them sort of melted into this creaminess. And the flavor was this terrific sweet tart balance that reminded me of a what I would call a late spring flavor of autumn quince paste. Like, it's a great condiment for cheeses and smoked duck and smoked pork products, those kinds of things where we want a sweet tart flavor that goes well with savory food.
Is this something you could just eat with a spoon?
Oh my, yes. And you know, if you didn't want to use it as a savory, it's a wonderful, it would be great with ice cream. It's sweet and tart. If you want to go the savory route, a hit of black pepper in there would be really nice. But just by itself, it was really interesting just with the rhubarb and the brown sugar.
That is such a great idea. What a great way to use up this rhubarb. And it's here at a few places. Just look for it and look for the red celery and you'll find it.
Absolutely.
That was Amelia Saltzman. She's the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, once again helping us negotiate our way through the fabulous offerings here at the market that we may otherwise have overlooked. Since we've declared it officially summer here at the Farmers Market, we have to talk with Fitz Kelly. He's one of our very earliest fruit farmers. He's got apricots, apriums, some nectarines, all kinds of stone fruit today. Fitz, so tell us what you've got on your truck and tell us what you really like today.
Well, there are three varieties that I really like. I like the Mayfire nectarine. You eat it and you say, I'm eating a nectarine, and wow, there's some sugar there. There's a little bit of acid. It makes for an interesting fruit. The other one is an aprium. It's an Orphan Annie aprium, which is a combination of apricot and plum. It is a huge percentage of apricot, just a little bit of plum. You right. Just had one.
Yes, to me it tasted like a plum, but it looked like an apricot.
Yeah, and everyone has a different opinion of that particular fruit. And the third one that we have today, which is really good, is a sweet one, and it's a Ring of Saturn. It's a flat peach which has a very small pit in it, but it eats like a white peach, and it is people really like them, or they say, what's the big deal? It's one of those non-controversial ones.
And it's a white peach.
It is a white peach, and it has a rose blush on the outside, but it eats really well if you like sweet.
Okay, and the Mayfire nectarine, that's an old-fashioned variety. Usually the earlier nectarines are yellow, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And they are also cling. Maybe middle of first or second week of June is when a lot of the freestones start emerging. They've just had enough time on the tree to separate the flesh from the pit. That is the definition of a freestone. The flesh is free of the stone, which is the pit.
Fitz is here. It's officially summer. The stone fruit is in, and we love tasting. The Mayfire nectarines are quite good, although there may be even a different variety next week. So do check it out. This is the Wednesday market where you'll find Fitz Kelly. Today, the Santa Monica Festival is taking place at Clover Park. That's the one at the corner of 25th and Ocean Park. It's a citywide festival celebrating everything good that the city of Santa Monica has to offer. Farmers Market will be there. There will be food, tastings. All the departments will be showing their various wares and programs. It's totally free, open to the public. It goes from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. So go on out to Clover Park this Saturday and check out Santa Monica Festival 2012.
A recipe from Amelia Saltzman is on the Good Food blog. Sorghum. Heard of it? It's been used for centuries in rural parts of Asia and Africa, and you probably wouldn't know it, but the United States is the largest exporter of the sweetener. It's long been a staple of southern pantries, but like many old-fashioned ingredients, it's now finding its way back into chefs' kitchens across the country. Chef Sean Brock of McCrady's and Husk Restaurants in Charleston, South Carolina, is here to explain just what that syrup is and how he uses it.
Sorghum, for me, is one of my biggest frustrations right now as a southerner and as someone who's trying to revive a specific pantry. People are labeling cane syrup as sorghum, and they don't taste anything alike. I grew up every morning with sorghum on my biscuits, and that flavor is embedded into my mind for the rest of my life. It's a very specific flavor.
How is it different from honey or molasses? Can you describe it to us?
It's more of a grain. It tastes more of a grain. It's earthier. It has that flavor that grains have, because essentially it is sort of a grain. I mean, it's a grass, but so is corn, and so is, I guess, wheat. It starts as a grass. So molasses essentially is cane syrup, cane juice reduced down. Sorghum is a specific plant that has even more uses than just syrup.
What does it look like when it's growing out in the field?
It's a very thin stalk that kind of looks like sugar, and then it has this tassel-y sort of seed head that hangs over. Inside are the seeds. You can take those seeds and grind them into a flour and use them to dust fish or fry things in or even make biscuits and bread. You can also take them and mill them a bit larger and cook them like grits or cook them like you would things like farro. You can take those seeds and deep fry them, and they pop like popcorn. So there are so many different uses out there that as Americans we're not really utilizing, in my opinion. But to me, it's the flavor of that syrup. It's this sort of grainy, earthy, pleasantly bitter sort of sweetener that just was such a huge part of my childhood. And as someone who spends all day long searching the South for ingredients, I've really only found one or two different places that are doing it the old-fashioned way, actually using sorghum and cooking it over an open fire with a horse-drawn press, the old-fashioned way, the way that I grew up doing it. You know, when I was a kid, once a year, it was like a social gathering. You would get together, and it was time to boil the sorghum down. And everybody took turns skimming the scum from the surface while the and feeding the fire, and you told stories and you caught up. It was almost like a reunion of sorts. And then in the end, when you decided that the syrup was ready, you just divvied up and everybody went about their ways. And that's, you had that sorghum for the rest of the year. That's it.
And what are the traditional uses for this kind of sorghum?
Oh, wow. Well, I'll tell you my favorite. Certainly the easy and most obvious are simply drizzling it over biscuits or cornbread straight from the oven. That's magical by itself. But the recipe and the dish that will resonate, you know, the most memories is an apple sorghum stack cake. You make a simple cake with sorghum, flavored with sorghum, and you make apple butter. And you do 12 layers of cake and apple butter, sorghum cake and apple butter, sorghum cake and apple butter. And then when you're done, you have this 12-layer object of beauty that sits on the counter and just has so much flavor. And that sorghum just has so much depth. So wonderful with that, those apples. And I make it all the time these days, straight from my grandmother's handwritten recipe. To be able to sit down and look at that cake on a plate, all those layers, and taste that sorghum and those apples is the most comforting and most wonderful thing you could ever imagine.
How hard is it to find real small-batch sorghum?
Totally impossible. Completely impossible. The reason that it's such a source of frustration for me right now is because I'm scared to death that it's going to disappear and it's going to be gone. I have seeds that I'm growing this year from a specific variety called Honey Drip that originated, these seeds originated from my hometown of Wise County, Virginia. And I can't wait to push those seeds into the dirt and watch them grow and tell the story and share those seeds with other farmers and inspire them to grow it so that sorghum is on every table, is part of everyone's pantry in the South, because it used to be and it needs to be now. It's just a shame that it's so hard to find. See, there's a beauty about a horse-drawn press. You know, a horse walking in a circle, turning the stones, someone feeding that sorghum through those stones and the liquid coming out, and a group of people tending a fire and putting that juice into the kettle and cooking it, and the smell of the wood burning, and the sounds of the horse trotting around, and just the conversations that are had over that kettle of sorghum. I mean, those are the things that can't die. That's a communal, beautiful communal thing that I was able to experience as a kid that I want to teach my children. This is food. Because when you do that, and you sit around, and you grow the plant, you go through that process, when it finally makes it to the table, and you sit down and you drizzle it over your biscuits, you find yourself chewing slower. And then as you're eating that sorghum, a movie's playing in your head of the experience that you had producing it. And you appreciate it more, and you respect it more. And you don't put more on the plate than you need. It's those types of lessons in life that make us truly appreciate and understand food and what it takes to get it on the plate.
You're my new hero, that's for sure. Thank you so much, Sean.
Oh, thank you.
Sean Brock is the chef and owner of two restaurants in Charleston, South Carolina, McGrady's and Husk. He's a pioneer in reviving heirloom seeds in the American South. Find a recipe for Sean's grandmother's apple sorghum stack cake. God, that sounds good. On the Good Food blog. You know what else you can make with sorghum? Rum. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll dive into some delicious rum cocktails and hear what the Bacardi family has in common with Fidel Castro. That's next, after this short break.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Rum has sparked the imagination of many a mixologist, and it seems that rum, kind of like wine, has a dizzying array of variables, from the raw ingredients it's made from to how it's actually made. The learning process is endless, and here to guide us through is Alan Katz. Alan's the general manager of Kanya Rum Bar in downtown LA. He's going to walk us through Rum 101.
Essentially, rum can be made from just about any type of sugar, whether it's fermented fresh cane juice or molasses. Most rum is made from molasses. With rum, it's divided not so much into just region, but also into distilling style.
Because it really is different from other spirits in that the distilling styles are so varied.
It's mind-boggling. Seriously, the most convoluted category of all, but so worth taking the time. The great thing about rum is that because of that incredible variety, it's impossible to get bored.
So describe these three major styles for me.
Certainly. Well, I brought some representatives along. First off, there's the English style. It is basically let rum be rum. This is molasses-based rum from the Caribbean, full of hogo, and hogo is that something rotten in a good way, kind of sweet stench that we've come to appreciate.
So we have this style. What would be, which is quite dark?
Yeah, basically, of the English style, most of these rums are in the rich, dark, full-flavored kind of realm. There are white rums that are excellent representatives of that style as well. So it's not to say that English-styled rum, it's all aged and it's all the dark stuff, but it is my favorite stuff. That's why I brought it along.
Okay, so we have the English-style rum. Then what would the other categories be?
All right, next up, Spanish. In this case, let rum be brandy. Interesting little anecdote going back to the first rum distillery on the books. I said on the books for any rum geeks out there that are already up in arms about saying this. Mount Gay, when they came up with their blend for their sugarcane brandy, this was basically the first time that anybody with a little marketability said, hey, we took this slave juice and turned it into a pretty good spirit. I could drink this neat. It makes fantastic punch. We need to get this out there. But everybody thinks that rum is garbage. So being that brandy was the spirit of the time, let's call it sugarcane brandy. That is how bad rum was just stymied from the start.
And you have a bottle of Havana Club here. Would that be included in that category?
It's only the finest of.
So delicious, that rum. Now, what is the third category?
Fresh cane. And this is the one where it can really vary greatly. So I brought two examples of fresh cane along with me. On one hand, there's Charbet Tropical Islands rum. Currently not in production, although I hear rumor that it's
now,
coming
back. Is Charbet an American company?
Yep. St. Helena, California. Totally family-owned and operated.
Where do they get their cane?
Hawaii. Marco and his father, Miles, they're rabid fishermen, and they love going down there for wahoo, and it also gives them a chance to oversee this little plot of cane. And when it's matured, they have it cut and shipped straight up to Ukiah, where they do all the hard work with it.
So is that unusual for rum to be made in America?
Not anymore. Rum is the original American spirit, and if there was any way for me to cap this era that we're enjoying right now with everything old becoming new again, I would have to say we're kind of rediscovering our roots. There were literally thousands of rum distilleries throughout the colonies, and those were just the ones on the books.
Thank you so much, Alan.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Alan Katz is the general manager of Kanya Rum Bar. If you like piña colada, Los Angeles has a special relationship with rum. Old-time places like Don the Beachcomber and Trader Vic's are actually thought to have invented the faux tropical cocktail, blended, of course, and then garnished with that little paper umbrella. And in the spirit of old being new again, a group of mixologists are reinventing those old umbrella-spiked drinks, sometimes in the simplest way. Steve Lavigne of La Descarga, another rum-focused bar here in L.A., admits his favorite cocktail is a simple daiquiri.
The original daiquiri is the daiquiri that you're seeing now in most of the, you know, the cocktail-driven bars and restaurants. And basically, it's just, it's three ingredients. It's rum, it's lime, it's sugar. Whether you shake it or you put it in a blender is your preference. But the original daiquiri, which was invented around 1900 in Cuba in a town called Daiquiri or Daiquiri, was invented, they say, by a gentleman named Jennings Cox. He did it sort of out of not having gin, basically. He was making gin, you know, sours, and decided to put Bacardi rum into the mix. And it stuck from there. And it was named after the city that they were in.
You know, it's interesting because I worked for a short time with a group of yachtsmen that were competing. And every day when they got off the boat, that's what they would drink. And nobody referred to it as a daiquiri.
What do they call it?
I don't know, sort of like grog. I don't know. It was the sailor. It seemed to be the sailor drink.
Well, that's kind of where I was going next with this. Is though they say that the, you know, the daiquiri, as it's called now, was invented around 1900. That combination of ingredients existed 200 years before that name was ever given to it, and it was a Navy grog. The British Navy issued rum to the sailors on the boat, and it was not well-made rum at that time. And so they added sugar to it to give it a more favorable flavor, and they added lime juice to it to keep scurvy away. So the daiquiri was being drank on British ships, you know, in the 1700s.
Do you serve it on ice or neat?
If we're talking about a hard-shaken daiquiri, and that's pretty much what you're going to see, that to me is the most delicious daiquiri there is. It's those ingredients, it's ice, it's a very rigorous shake in the tin, and there's some great videos of Japanese guys doing this in Japan. It's called the Japanese hard shake. And most cocktails, sours and stuff like that, you're going to see bartenders double straining them. So they're going to have the regular strainer that's on the tin and then another strainer, and that's going to catch pulp and any ice shavings that are in it. The daiquiri is the exception, in my opinion, to that rule. And when you hard shake that cocktail and you strain it, you want that kind of layer on the top of very small pieces of ice. And it gives some body and texture to the drink, too, not just in flavor, but it's kind of crunchy and it's extra cold.
And does the extreme shaking also give it a little foaminess?
It does. And though you can make daiquiris with simple syrup or sugar water, the recipe that I love the most, which is one that my business partner Pablo Moy came up with, is just 2 ounces of rum, 1 ounce fresh lime juice, and 2 bar spoons of superfine sugar. So it's the step down from granulated. And it adds the sweetness to it, the sugar, obviously, but there's a texture that comes from that sugar and not using liquid that reacts with the citrus, it reacts with the hard shake, and it you can feel it a little bit. It creates that foam on the top with the ice. When you taste that drink for the first time, it's just perfect.
Now, what kind of rum do you like to use for that?
In my opinion, there's 2 daiquiris. There's the daytime daiquiri, and then there's the evening, late-night daiquiri. And I think you could interchange them if you wanted to, but there are some flavor profile differences between the 2 daiquiris. The first one, I think, is just a perfect, and not a lot of people see this. You can get it at La Descarga. You can get it at Duty Freeze, and that's about it. And it's a replica bottle from 1909, and this is a little bit different Bacardi than Bacardi Superior. They called this Carta Blanca at the time, and this is the rum that made Bacardi famous.
It's such a delicious rum. It's a white rum.
It's a white rum, and this one, as opposed to Superior, is a little hotter, and they just distill it a little bit differently. It's a little creamier. It's in the style of the rum as it was in the turn of the century, which is appropriate for this drink. It's just got a brightness to it that makes it perfect for day drinking. I make daiquiris at home with this particular mark from Bacardi because I think it's the authentic recipe for that. But as you can see, there's another bottle next to it that that makes what I like as the evening daiquiri.
That kind of has a yo-ho-ho bottle of rum kind of feel to it.
It does, for sure. This bottle of rum, this is from Plantation. It's their 5-year Barbados rum. It's the best rum on the market for under $20, and it's just absolutely beautiful. The guys from Cognac Ferrand in France get the rum from the Caribbean, different islands. This one's from Barbados. And they ship the rum back to Cognac, France. And then they put the rum in cognac barrels for 6 months bottle it, and then send it around the world to whoever's buying it.
This is such a traditional drink. Surely at some point you have wanted to play with it. Do you have a kind of curveball riff?
Well, the funny thing is there's like 20 other recipes for daiquiris. There's the most famous, which is the Hemingway daiquiri, which is basically, you know, it's no sugar, it's all booze. And there's a lot of different variations using basically just changes in citrus. But yeah, the riff that I like to do on it is to add some bitterness to the cocktail. So what I'll do is the light rum, grapefruit juice, and either Aperol or Campari, and then a little bit of sugar. And it just, instead of it being like just a really nice flow of sweetness and citrus, the bitterness in the Aperol or in the Campari just like cuts it nicely at the end, dries out the mouth. And it's really, I think, makes it for an even better starter cocktail, like to the beginning of a meal or the first drink that you have, because it kind of gets you salivating for more.
It's sort of like a Negroni daiquiri hybrid.
Yeah, it's like a tropical Negroni.
I love that. Thank you so much, Steve.
Oh, my pleasure.
Steve Lavigne is the general manager of La Descarga, a rum bar in Hollywood. A recipe for Steve's hard shaken daiquiri is on the Good Food blog. In his book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause, Tom Jelton proves that Bacardi, and rum in general, are as synonymous with Cuban heritage as cigars. Through the lens of the Bacardi family, Tom tells the history of the Cuban Revolution. He joins us today to give us a glimpse of this powerful family.
I guess the impact of the Cuban Revolution, as far as the rum industry in Cuba is concerned, is that it nationalized what resulted in the nationalization of what had been private operations up until that point. Now, that's not obviously not just true for rum. It's true for all economic activity in Cuba as a result of the revolution was taken over by the state. And the rum industry that I'm most familiar with, or the rum operation that I'm most familiar with, was the one started by the Bacardi family in the middle part of the 19th century. They were by far the biggest and most famous rum operation in Cuba. The Bacardis developed what came to be known as Cuban-style rum, which is the light kind of rum that you can use to mix a daiquiri or a mojito or a Cuba Libre. Up until the Bacardis came along, there was no light rum like that. The Bacardis developed that. They really put Cuba on the map as far as rum production is concerned. And then about a year and a half after Fidel Castro came to power, he took over the Bacardi rum operation. And from that point on, rum making in Cuba was a state activity. That would be the main impact of the revolution on rum operations in Cuba.
And at that point, before the revolution happened, the word Bacardi was synonymous with rum. It was sort of like Kleenex, right?
Yeah, in fact, that's a really good analogy, Evan, because there was a famous court case in New York in the 1930s where if you went into a bar and asked for a glass of Bacardi, the bartender could just give you any old rum. I mean, it was just considered a generic term for a glass of rum, and the Bacardis were very upset about that. They actually took that hotel to court, and they succeeded in establishing the precedent that if you asked for a glass of Bacardi, you had to get Bacardi rum. But that was just an indication of how widely Bacardi was associated with rum at that time. It was almost used as a generic.
Once the Bacardis were gone and the Castro government took over the rum factories, what was the new name?
That is the most important part of the story, because I think the secret to Bacardi's success, more than any other factor has been their expert use of their knowledge, their understanding of the importance of branding. Rum was basically seen as a commodity. It was not a branded commodity. So rum was sold in barrels. There was no name associated with it. And when the Bacardis developed their unique style of rum, one of the things that they did was Facundo Bacardi himself signed the label on every bottle that went out from the factory so that people would know that they were getting the genuine Bacardi product. And throughout their history, the Bacardis have been known more than anything else for their defense of their trademark. And this is what the Bacardis cared most about protecting from Fidel Castro. The vast majority of the people involved in making Bacardi rum in Cuba stayed in Cuba. And that group included a number of craftsmen who were, you know, right at the center of the rum-making operation. And it's because of them that rum-making at the old Bacardi facilities in Cuba was able to continue uninterrupted after the revolution, because there were enough people there who remained there who knew how to make Bacardi rum, knew the secret formulas, etc. They were able to continue operations.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure to talk about rum. It's a subject that I care a lot about and have put a lot of time into studying.
Tom Gelton is an NPR correspondent, and his latest book is Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause. How do you like to enjoy rum? Daiquiris, blended, served with an umbrella, dark, light, molasses, floral? Join the conversation on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. I've got more good food coming up in 1 minute here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Time now for a visit from Jonathan Gold. He's, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the L.A. Times, and he joins us each week to tell us where to eat in L.A. Today, we're headed to Whittier for some Mexican food.
The restaurant is owned by the Diaz family, who owns Guisados, the wonderful taqueria in Boyle Heights, and they also have Cook's Tortas in Monterey Park. That's a really good tortas restaurant.
And what is this restaurant called?
This place is called, for a reason I cannot figure out, Bizarra Capital. I think it may be some Mexico City thing, but I'm not sure. And this is in a former, I think it was a Siete Mares restaurant. And it's nice. It's a big sort of roomy, very coffee shoppy beer pub. They have a lot of different beers, a lot of different beers. The one that I was the happiest to see was Victoria, which is this just delicious sort of lager from Mexico City that you don't see that often. They have it at La Casita too, but it has like a nice snap. The hops aren't overwhelming, but they're definitely present. If you like Mexican beers, you're going to like this one a lot. And since they have it on tap, you can have big, cold, foamy pints exactly as they should be done.
And so when we get our beer, what are the first things we're going to order off the menu to go along with it?
Bizarra Capital seems to be mostly a combination of the three restaurants he already has, you know, the Guisados, the Tortas place, and the ceviche place, whose name I can never quite remember. So, of course, you're going to start with the ceviche, and maybe you're going to get the aguachile, which is made with shrimp and fish in a very spicy sort of lime marinade served on fried tortillas.
So aguachile is raw shellfish.
Right. It's a Sinaloa sort of thing. You see it in town, like, not infrequently.
It's really light. It's a great way to start a meal.
And don't put ketchup on it.
No ketchup.
They have quesadillas, the Mexico City style ones that look like big fat turnovers. You can get one of those stuffed with, like, cheese or with mushrooms. But as always, I'm going to tell you to go with the huitlacoche, which is the
corn smut.
The jet black corn fungus that is so delicious, but it's probably better if you eat it blindfolded.
Yeah, not an attractive food.
There are, God help us, mole fries.
Really? So they're French fries that have been slathered in mole?
Yes, like chili fries, except instead of chili, you have mole.
Wow, that's a great idea.
They have a lot of the happy tacos from Guisados, including the Toreados, the ones that I infamously love, that are super hot chilies that are grilled and then put into the taco as the main ingredient of a taco, then slathered with more chili and a little bit of cheese. And I'm happy. Are you happy?
Oh, very happy.
We're all happy. The thing here that blew me away the last time was guisante, which is a usually unloved vegetable. Have you ever had guisante?
Yes. I'm trying to remember where I had it. But, you know, we haven't talked about guisante for a really long time.
I think the last time you and I talked about it, it was on the Lenten menu at La Casita Mexicana.
So describe what it is.
It is a member of the quinoa family. It looks almost exactly like quinoa growing. And if you don't know what quinoa growing is like, it looks like maybe broccoli that has been given shock treatment.
I love that. I just got like the best visual image.
So there are no sparks going off it, but it's all these tiny flowers and just profusion. And it's there's sort of like there's something so verdant looking about it that's almost frightening. I remember like running across it for the first time in Mexican market, trying to figure out what the heck I was going to do with it.
It looks more like something that you would put in a floral arrangement.
It would look beautiful in a floral arrangement. And taking it home and trying to cook it the way that I cook all, you know, greens, which is to, you know, basically, you know, you blanch them, you shock them in cold water, and then you saute them with, you know, salt, garlic, and good olive oil. And they're the most god-awful vegetable in the world done that way. I mean, just incredibly bitter. And they have these tiny stalks.
That never soften.
They never soften. So you're like, you know, A, it feels like you're chewing on twine, and B, you're like picking it out of your teeth for the next 20 minutes.
So what is the appropriate way to prepare guisantes?
Apparently, the appropriate way to prepare guisantes is to dip it in the same sort of egg batter that you would dip chile rellenos in and fry it. And the egg turns crisp and the guisante inside steams. It's like a bitter sweetness that's no more off-putting than kale. And you pick it up and you strip it with your teeth, like an artichoke, I guess. And so you're left with the stringy stalk, which you don't eat. And your mouth is covered with the, you know, sauteed chilies with which it is striped. And you're happy because it is a really, really good vegetable.
So besides the guisantes, what else are we going to get?
As you'd expect from somebody who owns, you know, guisados, there are tacos aplenty, filled with things like, you know, cochinita pibil, which is not the super fiery version, but a decent version of the pot-roasted Yucatan-style pork with achiote and garlic and whatever else turns it, you know, bright red. The, you know, very decent carne asada, which is done over an actual fire. You know, there's mole and there's a really almost crunchy when it's grilled kind of a homemade chorizo. And it wouldn't be often that we recommend dessert in Mexican restaurants, but I guess as long as we're going with the Lenten theme in these post-Lenten times with the guisante, we might as well get a capirotada, and they do one of the best versions in town.
Describe what capirotada is.
It's a bread pudding. In this size, it's like this giant cube of bread pudding with raisins in it and dates, and there's cream cheese, and there's sort of like this cinnamon cream that looks like, you know, the stuff that oozes out of Pillsbury, but in fact is so not. Probably one of these giant cubes is enough to feed an entire family, but you're going to eat it all yourself anyway because it's just that's the way you roll.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Bizarra Capital on Philadelphia Street in Whittier. Get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's favorite dishes by just texting the words good food to the number 69866. It's so simple. Just text good food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant map anytime you want. It lives on our Good Food blog. great food doesn't end at the L.A. County line. Our neighbor to the north, Ventura, has a lot of really wonderful places. And we count on Allison Costa to join us at least once a year to fill us in on what's going on in that great area to the north of us. Allison is a food writer, and she's the owner of Ventura Food Tours. And I think we're going to start off with some places that are a little off the beaten path.
Thanks, Evan. I wanted to talk about a couple places that you may not have heard about if you're visiting the Ventura area. And the first is Four Bricks Winery. And Four Bricks Winery opened, I guess, last summer. And what makes it unique is it's the only true winery in the city of Ventura. Other than the growing of the grapes, they do everything else at their facility there, which is on Eastman Avenue. The pressing, the fermenting, and the bottling all take place there. And they also have a neat little tasting room. And what makes it nice is that you can go in and do tastings. They usually have at least five of their wines available for tastings. But then you can also get a glass of wine or a bottle of wine. They do charcuterie and cheese plates, and you can also bring your own food in or order takeout from some of the places nearby. So it's a really fun place. It's owned by three couples from Simi Valley who kind of came together and decided to start their own winery. And the four in the name refers to their four favorite, I guess, regions of winemaking, Spain, France, Italy, and the state of California. So all the grapes that they use in their wines, you know, originated in those areas but are grown in California. So it's a really neat little place.
Now, what about coffee up there?
Coffee. There's a new coffee company called Beacon Coffee, and it was started also, I guess, in 2010 by a young couple, John and Jennifer Weir. He used to be a buyer and a roaster for Starbucks and Coffee Bean and decided to go out on his own. And luckily for us in Ventura, kind of brought the relationships that he has with all the growers that he met in his years with those other companies, kind of brought those to Beacon Coffee. And so he really has access to some of the best coffee around, single estate, high quality coffee beans. And they provide coffee, really, you know, freshly roasted coffee to a number of coffee shops in Ventura. But you can also stop in Monday through Friday during the week. You can stop in at their facility, which is off of Olivas Park Drive, and get a cup of coffee or an espresso there. And usually John is there, and he's one of those people that's just a wealth of knowledge of coffee. So if he's behind the counter when you order your espresso, you're in luck.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
So where else are we going to go?
Oh, gosh. There's another place called the Jolly Oyster, and it's really one of a kind. I've never heard of any place like this. It's not really a restaurant. It's not really a seafood shop. It's kind of a seafood concession trailer, and they're located at San Buenaventura State Beach. And in this nice little grassy area with picnic tables, and each of the picnic tables has a nice little grill next to it. And they specialize in shellfish, and you can go there and buy. They have oysters and clams. They do Manila clams and Kumamoto and Pacific oysters, which are grown in there. They have a shellfish farm down in Baja, and so they bring in the seafood about twice a week. And so you can go there, and you can buy your seafood and take it home and cook it at home, or you can bring all your fixins and kind of make a day of it. Alcohol is actually allowed at the state beaches, which is unusual.
That's so unbelievable.
I know. So you can bring beer and wine, whether you're going to drink it or cook with it or both. A lot of people will bring herbs and bread and butter and just cook their clams on the grill. They've got some supplies that they can give you. If you've never opened an oyster before, they'll sell you a knife and a towel and show you how to do it. So they don't do any food prep because they're not a restaurant, but they'll kind of instruct you on how to do it. So it's a really fun experience. Whether you're new to the world of shellfish or you're an expert at cooking it, it's pretty fun to spend the day there. One of the owners is this really jolly, handsome British man, and he's usually there, and his love of shellfish is kind of contagious. So he kind of adds to the experience as well.
God, that sounds so great.
Yeah, it's really neat.
Now, one thing we haven't touched on yet is beer. I know that there's some interesting stuff happening up there now when it
yes,
comes to beer.
There's we have a new brewery in Ventura called Surf Brewery, and that's actually not too far from Four Bricks Winery, kind of located on Market Street in kind of an industrial area. And they started brewing beer also in 2011, and they have a brewery where you can stop in and do tastings, you know, get a sampler of 5 beers or 10 beers, or you can just go and have a pint there as well. And they actually, a cool little crossover, they actually sometimes use Beacon Coffee in the filtering process of their beer. So there's a lot of new little companies doing really cool stuff and kind of partnering together as well.
So we've explored a little bit of sort of the back unusual areas of Ventura. And I know every time you come, I look forward to hearing your take on the best thing that you ate all year. So do you have that for us?
I do. I do have some favorites. The first, actually, I'll start in Ojai. The first is something that I ate at a place called the Ojai Beverage Company in Ojai. And speaking of beer, Ojai Beverage Company has lots of beer. It's kind of the front part of Ojai Beverage Company is sort of your typical but very large liquor store. They have over 1,000 wines, 2,500 spirits, and I think over 250 beers that you can buy. And then they have kind of a tasting room / restaurant in the back. And so when you go in there, you can taste any of their beers. They have always have at least 20 beers on tap, some local beers, beers from Surf Brewery, beers that they make there, and then also really unusual beers from around the world. And they actually have a dish on their food menu called Blow Your Mind Chicken. It's kind of buffalo wings deconstructed. They take shredded white meat chicken and simmer it in a buffalo sauce, and then mix that with crumbled gorgonzola and chopped crispy bacon, and they serve it on a leaf, endive leaf. So it's just like a little bite. I think they come six to an order. Really, really delicious. It sounds good, but it's amazing. It's one of those things you take a bite and you're like, you kind of want to order another batch because six is definitely not enough, and it's a good thing to go with all that beer.
So now are we leaving Ojai and going back to Ventura?
Yes. I have a couple things in Ventura that I wanted to mention. There is a new place called Himalaya in Ventura, and it's kind of right on the outskirts of downtown at the corner of Ventura Avenue and Main Street, and it's kind of a mix of Indian food and then Nepali and Tibetan dishes. So there's, you know, Indian dishes like mulligatawny soup and tandoori chicken, and then other specialties like a Sherpa curry made with goat meat. And then they also have some fusion dishes, like they have a burger that they top with paneer, you know, the Indian cheese, and they do lamb tikka, like a burrito, basically lamb tikka wrapped in naan bread. And they make this chicken tikka pizza, which is really, really good. They bake it on you know, fresh-made naan bread with kind of a sweet and spicy chili sauce. And then they put the chicken tikka that's been cooked in the tandoori oven and then thinly sliced onions and chopped cilantro. It's one of those pizzas you kind of start out to maybe share it with other people at your table, and then you find that you don't really want to share it. It's that good.
One thing we haven't talked about is the good old American burger.
Yes, and there is a place called the Top Hat in Ventura that was actually located right in downtown, this tiny little burger stand that was open for about 60 years. And as you can imagine, had a really loyal following. And it closed in 2010. And just recently, a friend of the family who owned the Top Hat reopened the Top Hat in Midtown Ventura. Same menu, same recipe, same vibe. It's a little bit bigger, but it's still kind of like a burger stand. And if you want a good chili cheeseburger, that's where you go. It's not a pretty burger. It's not gourmet. There's no arugula or fresh baked bun. It's just simple bun, burger, cheese, and chili. I wouldn't even recommend wasting the calories on fries or onion rings there. It's just you go for the chili burger or chili dog or both.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah,
Thank you so much, Allison.
Sure. Thank you.
That was Allison Costa. She's a food writer and now owner of Ventura Food Tours. We'll have a list of all of her picks that she shared with us today, as well as a link to her food tour website, all on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Next up, a community oven right here in Los Angeles. Find out more in 30 seconds here on Good Food.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Good Food. The wood-fired oven. Oh, it's a beautiful thing. It creates perfectly charred pizza and caramelized vegetables, but it's rare that we home cooks have access to one. Here in LA, a group of home cooks with a passion for baking sought to remedy that by constructing a communal wood-burning oven. Independent producer Sasha Woodruff followed their success.
I'm starting a fire. I'm just using some old 2x4s and some crumpled up newspaper. Well, I'm getting going at 8 o'clock for pizza by 11. I'm Martin. I helped out building the pizza oven. I was sort of quality control. I'd had a little more experience with masonry than some, but it was an incredible group effort with a whole lot of people who didn't have experience throwing themselves into it in great ways. You build the fire towards the door of the oven after, oh, probably about 20 minutes, half an hour, and you start working it back into the oven. Fire's looking pretty good. We're getting a lot of flame. I'm going to just continue to feed it all this, these little bits of kindling.
Welcome, everyone. This is the inaugural firing of the cob oven that we all built. Yes, a round of applause for everyone who helped build it. The first thing we're going to do is bake pizza. And when we do that, we keep the fire going, shove it to the back of the oven, bake the pizza kind of in the front of the oven. My name's Eric Knutson, and I'm one of the co-founders of the Los Angeles Bread Bakers. I hope this is a resource for people to learn how to bake bread and pizza and other things that you would use in a wood-fired oven. And I think it's a nice way to provide a sense of community.
It's like the launch of the space shuttle. That's what I'm here for. I'm Joseph Schuldiner, director of the Institute of Domestic Technology in Altadena. Oh, it's basically a sort of an open-air university about food crafting, and bread is obviously a food craft.
My name is Teresa Seitz, and I'm a founder of Los Angeles Bread Bakers and also the secretary. It's our first oven, and our plans are to build more ovens throughout Los Angeles. So this was a chance for us to get our feet wet and figure out how to do it.
You know, we live in a challenging economic time, and I think a lot of people are interested in learning how to make their own food from scratch. So certainly one of the hopes I have for the Los Angeles Bread Bakers is that we're a resource for people to learn how to cook for themselves. And bread is the staff of life and an essential part of our diet, and it's something that's actually fairly easy to make and inexpensive.
Obviously, wood-fired pizza is the new Prius. So there's this whole wood-fired thing happening in L.A., which is super exciting.
All right, Kristen, we're going to get the fire ready, if that's okay.
All right, is everybody ready for pizza?
Look at that. Getting 800 on the floor.
Okay, now what's the dome?
Max.
Hi.
What is it?
We know it's above 1,020 degrees in the top.
Mission accomplished.
That's what you want.
Yeah. Kristen Ferguson. I'm a pastry chef, actually. I worked for years at the W Hotel, and that's where I got really interested in pizzas. The main secret to the dough is you must keep it moist. You don't want a stiff dough. It has to be really soft. So soft that you think it's like a mistake.
Ooh, pizza number one.
We just put a pizza in here, and we're going to let it cook for a little bit, and then we have to keep turning it because the fire is in the background.
Cutting board coming through.
Gorgeous! Oh. Look at that with the ash on the side.
this side is fantastic.
The pizza's delicious. It was our first one. It's a little charred on the bottom, but I love that. It's kind of interesting that this group did this very organically. We know nothing about what other people are doing in the country or California, and we just wanted an oven.
Well, I think every Sunday you can hear people saying, give us this day our daily bread. It is woven into the background of many of our cultures. More people have become aware of community ovens. Community ovens will pop up in a small community in Colorado, like Carbondale, where a bunch of people there decided that, they wanted to have a community oven, and they worked for a couple of years to get the location and the funding for it. There's an oven in what's called the Tenderloin National Forest in San Francisco, bread oven in Braddock in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Youngstown, Ohio, and it's happened in Australia, in Canada, several states in the United States.
There's a Los Angeles that people imagine, and then there's a Los Angeles that actually exists. It's just normal, ordinary people who have a lot of vision.
Community ovens probably go back to when you had a village that wanted to be efficient about its baking. So, it probably goes back to the creation of bread 6,000 years ago. I'm David S. Cargo, and I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I have a website that is titled Quest for Ovens, and I have been interested in wood-fired ovens for probably since about 2006. I believe that bread can be traced back to Egypt. You know, it's part of the Fertile Crescent. It was where they were growing grain. And I've heard it said that bread was made from beer and beer was made from bread back in Egypt because it was all one kind of yeast.
Community ovens is what people baked in, or peasants baked in, because once you heat the oven up, it's good for a day. And so they would, there'd be an oven master in a lot of French towns, I guess, who would load up the oven, and there were places where people could prepare their loaves, basically kneading tables, and load the oven, and they'd be able to bake for a fee. And that's been a tradition in Europe for, let's say, since Roman times.
The folklore is that the old-fashioned community baker, that there was a hole in the counter, someone was down below pulling a piece of the dough off to make his own loaves out of, and that you never knew it was happening.
The story that I'm familiar with is that it was a part of the deal, was that the women would bring their risen breads, and he would cut off a piece from everybody's loaves, and that was the kind of payment that they gave him. And then he would combine all of those bits and pieces and make these loaves himself and sell those, and that would be a little extra tip for him. I'm Andrea Crawford, and I'm a devoted bread baker. I grind my own flour and keep my own levain going, and I bake for my family every week.
I've got to finish cleaning out the embers here. We had five, mid-fives, in the on the hearth, and a little bit hotter in the dome, but it's time to go.
We're transitioning out of pizza. Now we're lowering the temperature of the oven to bake bread. We just took my first loaf out of the oven. It's got that nice
hollowness.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
You know what? Every time I bake a loaf and it comes out, it's a miracle to me, and I still get excited. It's alchemic.
Independent producer Sasha Woodruff produced that story for Good Food. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at our website, kcrw.com, or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand, which is incredibly easy, on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food's produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia is our segment producer, and our executive producer is Harriet Ells. As always, we thank Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.